Welcome to the Feasting on Design podcast. I'm your host, Jason Frostholm. Today, I'm talking with dimensional typographer Danielle Evans. We chat about carving emu eggs, how she's learned to trust her gut when red flags start to pop up with clients, being a specialized generalist, how she keeps her work fresh and innovative in the face of growing competition, defending her work when people start copying her and encroach on her projects, plus a whole lot more. Danielle, thanks for joining me tonight.
Oh, thank you so much for having me yet again.
Yes, it has been forever since we've had a chance to talk. So this is a good excuse to catch up and figure out what's been going on with you and what's happening in the world. And, you know, I'm really excited about this one because with the launch of Feasting on Design, you're one of the first people that I've talked to who directly deals in food.
Yeah.
On a daily basis. So let's use that as a starting point and just give a quick recap of who you are and what you do, and we'll roll from there. How about that?
Absolutely. That's perfect. Well, my name is Danielle Evans. I am a food and dimensional typographer. And what that means is I make lettering, which is drawn typography, but I use food and objects to do this. So oftentimes that means my job requires art directing, photography, styling, retouching, video, and sometimes stop motion. And altogether, the work that I produce becomes social media campaigns, commercials, outdoor signage, various like editorials, things like that. So it's a very interesting line of work, oftentimes smelly, mostly delicious.
So the TLDR on that is you get paid money to play with food, which our parents tried to stop us from doing when we were kids.
Absolutely. My mom was not special in the sense that I remember watching Close Encounters of the Third. Is it the third kind or the fifth kind?
Third kind.
I always get this confused. And I remember trying to make the mashed potato mountain on my dinner plate. I'm like, look, it's the potato mountain. And I remember just this swift smack on the back of my head. Like, we don't do this. We are not animals. We were not raised in barns. I'm like, oh God. Okay. And
yeah,
now she's
I got that a few times. Mom, look, if you hadn't stopped me when I was a kid,
yes,
think how much further I would be right now.
Correct. I would be a progeny.
And I'm sure being a mother, she looks at it as like, no, this just helped you not work it out of your system, so now you get paid to do it.
Yeah.
I helped you along.
Yeah, that is kind of the angle she's taken. She's a great marketing person.
I'm just speaking from the experience of I'm pretty sure that's how my mom would have spun it.
Yeah, so. I think that's moms are really good at spinning things, is what I've decided. They're great at it. Yes.
Yeah. So since we're talking about food and how you work with it, I mean, because you're crafting this stuff into shapes and letter forms and images and things like that. What is that process like?
Oh, that's a great question. So oftentimes the process starts with determining either what I'm going to say, so coming up with the copy, or deciding what I want to use, coming up with the materials. So I feel like either of those ideas tends to inform the other. And then on top of that, I have to start thinking about lettering treatments and, you know, am I going to go for something retro? Am I going to go for something that's a little bit more wild, or am I going to push legibility? Am I going to be interested in energy? I feel like these are questions that when you're doing lettering, you are rarely able to have all of them. So it's figuring out on a scale which ones are most important. Most people that work with lettering, again, are working on the computer or they're working with pencil or paint. And so they have a very solid understanding of the predictability of those things. Whereas when I'm working with food and objects, every single item is different. Every single item has a different breaking point, a bending point, a point where it'll pile up, and a point where it'll spill everywhere. And so it's my job to figure out not only how to create something that feels visually interesting and feels typographically correct, but also to make it look appetizing, because some of these items have a half-life. And so getting it done sure. in the allotted time is really important. And it doesn't always happen. So essentially, there's a lot of brainstorming and conceptualizing. And because I've been doing this now for 6 years, there's a lot of experience that goes into deciding some of these things. But then I'll start going, okay, is this going to be a still image? Is this going to be a video? Is this going to be a time lapse? Is this going to be stop motion? What is the end result for this thing? And I start dreaming about that process, because while I'm doing the lettering process, I also have to consider lighting. I have to consider photography. I have to consider camera movement. Just constantly like considering these processes and how they all marry together. And sometimes if a budget is really good, or I just have people I'm collaborating with, someone else gets to worry about that. And that's great. But oftentimes if I'm working on something myself, I have to worry about that. So it becomes a lot of head games and a lot of, have you seen that gif of a woman with the math all over her face? That's me. Like any given time.
Yes, I have seen that. Yeah.
Doing quackulations, basically. Looking confused. Yeah.
Well, so after doing this for 6 years, I realize it's going to vary between, you know, what type of food and what type of item you're using, but are there ones where you know that you've had more success and you've got more predictability with?
Correct.
Over others that you tend to try to gravitate towards if you can?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I think like most people, sometimes we get infatuated with either certain design styles or certain color palettes, and we just live in them for a little bit. And I find
sure.
I tend to do that. Like I had a meringue period this past month. you know, I've had periods of time where I was like, how many different ways can I make coffee interesting? Or last year I grew a bunch of crystals and that made me sound like very zen or something. Mm-hmm. You know, I just go through phases where I'm like, I'm working on stuff and all of it's interesting and all of it is pushing me to learn something. And it's almost like there's an internal clock where once I hit where I feel like I've learned enough on the subject, I can put it down and then I can try something else. And sometimes I come back to it and sometimes I don't. But it's this really interesting internal journey that if you look at my artwork in a chronological way, you can go, oh, she was stuck on that for a minute and then moved to something else. So yeah, it's fascinating. I think we all have that though in our work.
Yeah. Well, I mean, speaking of things that you were stuck on for a minute, you had a big period of eggs for a while last year.
Yes, I did.
First question I have, where does one procure an emu egg?
Etsy. Happy to elaborate.
Of course it's Etsy.
Yes.
Of course it's Etsy.
Yes.
And how many did you go through before you figured out how to not like either underdo it or overdo it?
You would be very surprised. So first and foremost, I went through an egg phase. That egg phase became a project, and that project became Kanyeg. So Kanyeg is Kanye quotes and lyrics made out of eggs. And you would not believe how many ways there are to fry and boil and skin an egg, basically. So I like this duality and this paradox of the humble, noble egg to this rap mogul who has this huge personality and is so...
Who is not humble.
No, not at all. He's an egoist, essentially.
Yes.
And so I enjoyed like putting these two things together because they were just so weird. Like who the fuck would think to do this? And I remember telling someone that I was seeing at the time, I was like, I think I need to make this project. And I told him about it and he laughed. And I was like, this guy has no sense of humor. It must be good. Like I have to do this. So I searched online and found an emu egg farmer. An emu farmer in Ohio, strangely. Uh-huh. And they just happened to have a handful of eggs. And so I was like, hey, could I get a few of these? I might mess this up. I'm really not sure what I'm doing. And they're like, you know what? We're going to give you a BOGO deal. And I threw in a third just because. So I still have two emu eggs sitting over here on my shelf in my studio. eventually I'm going to do something with them. I don't know what, but they're going to be a thing. And I did most of my practicing on regular eggs, on like brown farm eggs. And let me tell you, it's not the same. I think just threw some of those out, but they were very rudimentary. The shells were very delicate and I couldn't get a clean cut. Whereas on an emu egg, it's really thick. It has three different layers, a dark green layer, a teal layer, and then a white layer underneath. Mm-hmm. And so I watched a couple videos online and I went, let's go for this. And I kept trying to, I made a drawing and I kept trying to transfer it onto the egg, but the egg wouldn't sit still. And the drawings kept fudging off. Like whenever I would smear them and they'd come like completely off on my hands. And so I went, oh no, I got to freehand this. Oh no. And of course, like working on a curved surface was really different, but I was able to get the right iteration of it and then started carving. So I carved out the dark green, got to the blue layer. Eventually was like, I think I want this to be an inline. I'm going to make a cut down to the white, got to the white layer and managed to get the egg like photographed. It was beautiful. But what I didn't know is that you're supposed to then coat the egg in like vinegar or something to harden the white shell, and it deteriorated out.
Oh no.
Whoops. So I was faced with a choice. I'm like, I think what I need to do is carve the white parts completely out, and then I'm going to bedazzle it and I'm going to turn it into a necklace. So I made a diamond crusted piece. It took almost 400 Swarovski crystals to cover this egg. And I spent 3 weeks gluing crystals onto this egg in coffee shops all over my city. And people were just like, what the hell is this person doing? And I'm like, I'm an artist. And I wore my Creative South hat while I was doing this. And I had my ripped jeans and people were like, you are an artist. Like, I hate myself.
What? So what did you use? I mean, did you use like a Dremel or something to carve it? Because that thing's like almost a quarter inch thick.
Yes. Well, they have special Dremel pieces and they have a hose. So you have to use like a...
Oh, you've got like water? You've got to do water?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's very
delicate. So it's like carving a stone almost.
Almost. Yeah. It's a very delicate process. And I figured out a way to do it that wasn't super invasive and enough that I would do it again. I would absolutely do it again.
Well, you got two eggs left to do it.
I do.
Now, my next question is, of those two eggs remaining, please tell me that you like, you know, cracked them and drained the insides out of them.
I mean, they came to me that way. I was very
curious.
Okay,
good, good, good.
I was curious. I mean, they're big. I wanted to see the big yolk. I wanted to make like 20 omelets at one time. It sounded great.
I'm curious about it too. So when I was in college, I actually worked in a restaurant, and for some reason we had ostrich meat on the menu.
What?
Like it was ostrich fillets. Yeah, it tastes like steak. It's really lean and it's not gamey at all. But the vendor who brought it to us actually brought us an ostrich egg one time. And they cracked it up and made a bunch of omelets.
Wow.
It tastes remarkably similar to a chicken egg. It's a little, it's a little stronger in flavor. That's all I can. It tastes more eggy than a regular egg. That's the best way I can describe it. More yolky, actually.
Yolky. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So it was just richer.
Oh yes. Okay. That makes sense to me in a really strange way. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, so I've tried ostrich. I mean, I'm assuming emu egg tastes remarkably similar. They're both big flightless birds.
Anything with like giant legs that anybody at a Renaissance fair would die to eat. Yes.
I think that's the only like not chicken egg I've ever eaten too.
Gotcha.
No, I've had quail egg before at like a sushi place. I take that back.
Sweet. Yeah, that's pretty dope. Yeah. Well, one of my friends raises quail. However, she found out after buying the quail and raising them and eating the eggs that she's allergic to them. So,
oh no.
So she occasionally will bring them to me and yeah, I'll eat them. They're like poppable.
It's a little tiny egg snack.
Yeah, an egg snack.
So getting back to working with the different substrates, when you're working with like an emu egg, you've almost got a dichotomy that you've got to work with, where the exterior is extremely hard, but if you go too far, it becomes extremely fragile, and you can, how do you feel that? How do you ride that line of I'm right at the edge of where it's going to fall apart in my hands? And how do you test that?
That's a great question. And I feel like all of the work that I do is like that, is like pushing it to the limit, basically.
That's why I asked.
Yeah. You were hatching a good question. Yes. So I think a lot of it is kind of listening to yourself. Strangely, even if you've never had experience with some of these things, you can go, okay, I can feel that if I go a little too far here, I'm going to regret it. Like, you feel the pressure of it. And so you kind of back yourself off a little bit. I try not to make certain moves unless I'm certain I have a backup plan for what to do if it fails. So I like to say that working digitally is like playing checkers, in the sense that you can make endless amounts of moves. You can redo and undo your moves. And there might never be a clear winner, because the game might never play out. Like, you could just drop it. whereas working in analog like this with different items is like playing chess. And you have to think about these moves more carefully. But you can make less moves and win the game. Although sometimes you have to make more. It just depends. Sure. But you can win or lose more quickly, provided it's easier to win if you're willing to sit down and really think a couple moves ahead. So you have to be very strategic and intentional. And again, I had backup eggs in case this didn't work.
Sure.
But really just,
well, that's just being smart.
Trying to. But just being sensible about, like, okay, I don't know my capabilities with this. I've never tested it before. What experience do I have that is similar to this? Do I have any? What would I do in any other circumstance? Like, can I be careful? Like, this Dremel thing is really shaky. How do I hold this egg so that I'm not crunching it, but at the same time making it, like, getting these clean lines? And so in a lot of ways, you're making tiny little moves that feel very bold and daring, but really they're just baby experiments within a larger experiment.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
When you're working with, say a client comes to you and pitches an idea, but they want you to work with some type of food you haven't worked with before. Mm-hmm. Say, I can't think of any you haven't worked with at this point, but
there's a lot though.
I know you've worked, but just say for some reason they specifically want Szechuan peppercorns from some weird place, and it may not be something that's readily accessible to you and easy to work with. How much time do you allow yourself to experiment and get a feel for that material before you proceed and dive in?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I found that there's, like, again, a balance. If I have experience with something, like a material, I can push myself typographically. Besides, it's the only way I'll find the project to be interesting. I don't want to do the same thing over and over.
Sure.
But then if I've never worked with a substance before, I'll go, hey, you know what? I'm going to test this. And I'll build that into my quote. So I'll make sure I have an afternoon where I get every version of this, whether it's the dry pepper, the seeds, something crushed up, ground, and I will just play with it a dozen different ways and try to figure out what the best use is for this project. And then I'll take screenshots, or like I'll take pictures on my phone, and I'll be like, hey, here's what came of my testing day, and this is what I learned, and which of these makes the most sense to you? How do you feel about this or this? This is my recommendation. So by the time I go into it, if I feel like I've kind of resolved some of the conflict that I'm having in the testing phase, then I'll push myself typographically. But if I don't, if it's still tricky, then I'll be like, you know what, I'm going to stick to something safer, some sort of treatment that I've done before, something I know, or maybe in a lot of ways, like sticking with a serif, or I'm sorry, a sans serif is easiest in most cases. So I'll just be like, yeah, this is going to be a little bit blockier, or have these things to it. So I'm constantly trying to build in safeties where there's a lot of risk in this kind of work, but how can I control the things that I want to control? What are the constants? How do I handle those? And I think everybody has opportunity to do that in their own field. You know, you can challenge yourself and grow and explore, but you don't have to feel like you're completely like balls to the wall every single time. It's okay to just risk a little, and risking a little is how we grow.
Yeah. I want to come back to that in a minute.
Okay.
But I got a question, because you talked about control. How do you, because when you're working with food, there's a lot of factors that aren't necessarily within your control. How are you, when you're working with it, finding that balance between maintaining as much control to get the desired effect you want, but allowing for those, you know, happy accidents.
The Bob Ross happy accidents. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. I almost went there. Those happy accidents that, you know, spill over. Say like, you know, you're doing something in like a liquid, like ketchup or something like that. And, you know, you get to this certain point and for some reason, you know, you get that ketchup fart on the bottle and it splatters a little
thing.
Bit.
Yep. That's a thing.
You know, at what point do you decide, like, no, that actually added something to it,
mm-hmm.
versus, okay, I've got to clean that up. How do I clean this up without messing this up and stuff like that? How, you know, how are you finding that balance?
So for me, it's a question of, I think of every stroke as having a hard side and a soft side. And by hard side, I mean like something legible, something straight, something clear edges.
Sure.
And then the soft side is where like stuff spills out or has more energy. It's again, that idea of, are you going to be legible or are you going to be energetic, and realizing that that's on a spectrum and you choose where you want to fall. So realizing like, if I am in the middle of making a stroke that's going to become a letter form, like an actual, like an I, for example, and it farts out on me, I'm going to have to clean it up, because that's not going to register to anybody. It's not even probably registering to me. So I have to take that moment to be like, this is not, I have to be honest with myself. You have to, if you're in this kind of work, you have to be self-reflective and honest. Like, truly, can I get away with this? The answer is no, I must start over again. But if it happens on, say, like a swash or an incidental somewhere on the end of a ball terminal, then you're like, oh, that's cute. How fun. I feel like Christoph Waltz in oh, how fun.
yeah.
That's really true sometimes. And so I think it's just allowing yourself to make the quote unquote mistake and realizing it's not a mistake. It is a happy accident. It's not purposeful, but it doesn't mean it doesn't add.
Sure.
And so in some cases I find, I let the client know like, hey, by the way, I made a sketch for you and I'm going to get it as close as I can, but there might be some incidental things going on and we're just going to roll with it. But more importantly, and this is my phrase for when I don't know what's going on, I'm like, we're going to learn together. It'll be great. And they love that.
when you are working with, you know, clients versus doing your own thing, you know, at this point, you've built up enough of a reputation that I would assume a lot of creative directors are coming to you because they trust you and they want your take on it and they want your opinion on it. But when you're working with someone new who, you know, has seen your work and just likes your work, but they haven't really worked with you before, you know, how are you communicating, you know, this is the process, this is how it works, you know, there's going to be some things and inconsistencies and, you know, and you want that, like, because, you know, in case you haven't noticed, those of us who are art directors and creative directors, we tend to be control freaks sometimes. So the unknown can be, you know, while we're artistic, that unknown can be a little scary.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. You would think like at some point you get to a space where your reputation precedes you, but that's really not true. I find everybody has to constantly prove themselves over and over and over again. So really what it just means is, okay, I have the storehouse of experience I can pull from. If someone is like, what does this process mean? I'll go, okay, here's a sketch I delivered in a different city. without any understanding of where I was going to get any of this food or being at this restaurant that you guys are asking me to do this work for. I'm going to go do this project in a different city, and somehow I'm going to get the exact same food that you guys are using in your restaurant. We're going to figure it out. And looking at the sketch to the final product and them going, wow, you did the damn thing. And I went, yep, I'm here until it's done. Like, that is different, you know, that's different.
Yeah.
And I think being, first of all, being willing to be like, hey, I'm going to be here until something is finished. I'm going to work really hard to keep the integrity of my sketch. I'm going to ensure that you guys are happy. Like, just those assurances, I guess people don't do that all the time. And so to be someone who's like, I've already thought about this and I'm here for you, goes a long way. It goes a very long way. I'm so surprised.
Gotcha. How do you deal with the differences between being able to do work out of your home studio where you know all the equipment you've got, you know everything that you know how the lights are going to heat up, like say you're working with like cheese or something like that, how the lights are going to heat up the cheese and how long you have to work with it, versus when you've got to go on site somewhere, you know, say you're at Target and you're in their studio working on something and they've got a lot more lights that have got a lot more power than the ones that you have at home, because you know they're a billion-dollar company.
Yes.
Yeah. And you are not a billionaire, to my knowledge.
No, I'm not. Not even close.
Yeah. How do you deal with those differences of, you know, kind of the different tolerances within the material based on the different environment? Because this is
No, it's okay.
You go ahead and answer.
No, it's a great question. You're asking great questions. So it's a qualifier heavy conversation going, hey, sure, just so you know, I've seen that yogurt, for example, goes bad in 40 minutes under these kinds of lights. We're going to have to turn these lights off until we are absolutely certain we're ready to shoot. We are going to have to do this, this, and this, and try to keep the studio cool. If that's not possible, then I'm going to need to go outside, as long as we have a cart for this. And so I'm just constantly trying to problem solve before I even get into their space, because in some cases I just don't know. And that's
sure.
That's okay. But just showing people that I'm willing to think about the potentials that could arise is, I think, extremely helpful to them, because they're like, oh, I haven't thought about this. I didn't know that was a thing I had to worry about. It sounds like this person knows what they're talking about. And so by constantly trying to anticipate what could go wrong, you end up minimizing a lot of what will go wrong. And so most of my shoots in recent years, knocks on wood that happens, have been wonderfully smooth. The only time they've not been smooth is when the client doesn't know what they want. And it doesn't seem like, regardless of what options I give them, that I'm going to be the person to solve that. So that's when things get really difficult, when they're divided, when they're unsure, and when they're not really listening. So those are things out of my control.
Sure. Well, I mean, so what you said right there, that's something that we all have, no matter what type of designer you are and what you work in, we all get those clients who don't know what they want. And I mean, thankfully with experience, we get better and better at sussing out those red flags.
Yeah.
What's your process for, you know, or how good is your radar, I guess, is the better question, at figuring that out?
It's pretty good. And the sad thing is that sometimes you can know that about a client and you still take it because you're like, this is good money and I have to take it to keep open. Like, that's important.
Sure.
And
sure.
So that part gets really hard. Whenever anyone comes to me and goes, hey, I hear you're a stylist, I'm like, that is not what I do. You can find someone much cheaper and much less interesting that is willing to just do whatever exactly you've asked of them from the beginning. But I am here to come up with creative ways to solve a problem. And so that becomes a really interesting thing. And it's also a huge pay decrease. If someone comes to me for styling, I mean, they're asking me for a day rate and won't want to pay me much more than that. They're going to expect me to hop around and get them groceries. And I'm like, I will do that, but that's not my job is bigger than that. So that gets weird. When people question what I will be doing on a set, I have to explain to them I'm somewhere between a photographer and a stylist. I guess an art director is the best way to describe what I'm doing. So So if you're looking for someone, you're looking, like, if you're looking for someone that can handle all of that, you're looking for me. If you're looking for someone that is willing to speak to everybody on the team and know exactly, like, what they're expected to do and is able to intelligently dialogue with them, then you want me. If you just, again, want someone that's going to show up and do a job, then I'm not the right person. And if you want someone who's going to be like the photographer that has all the fancy equipment, that hosts people, then that's not really me either. Like,
right.
I'm somewhere in between those two. And if they can't grasp that, then that's not a good sign either. And there have been clients I've had where they just didn't read the brief. They didn't open the emails. They didn't look at concepts. And I'm just thinking, like, you're wasting my time. You're wasting all of our times. You're moving so fast that you're not paying attention. And that's a huge red flag also. So yeah, that's where this gets really interesting.
Yeah. Cause I mean, I think people get confused that yes, you can take pictures and yes, you are good at photography, but you're not a professional photographer.
No, it's a big difference. So
that's, yeah. I deal with that at work too. And it's like, I can take a good picture. I can, I know how to light something, but there's a lot better people out there at it than me. I'm a step above a guy with a camera.
Yes, I understand that. And it's like, I prefer that. Don't you prefer to have someone that does their job really well and you get to work with them? And it's also like you get to learn from them and you also get to teach them about what you do. Like, it's a beautiful kind of symbiotic thing. It's mutually beneficial. Why wouldn't you want other people being their best and kicking ass and making you look good while you're making them look good? That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, it's weird because, I mean, you see now, like, everywhere, like, if you see a job posting anywhere, they're wanting someone that does, like, 17 people's jobs. Yep. And it's like, that person doesn't exist.
Nope. And if they do, you better be willing to pay them for at least three of those people's jobs. Yes.
Well, yeah. And that's the thing, is they want to pay them for someone who's fresh out of school.
Correct.
And they want, someone who, can code, develop, do branding, do, animation, do video photography, audio. Yeah. It's like, you want like entire departments.
Yes. The thing is that when I came into this line of work, I was coming in around the time all of these very well-known people were talking about being specialists, and they're like, specialists is, that's the way to be, you do one thing, you do it really well. And I was like, I do a lot of things pretty okay. I don't know how to do one thing really well. I don't. And I hated that as a thought. I'm like, you know what? I have multiple skill sets I want to use, and I want to use them all the time. That's how I continue to feel like I'm useful and I'm interesting. But that's not to say that people that have a specialist output are any less special. Like, it's acknowledging that both of these can exist and that both of them have their drawbacks, but also they have their perks. And I think in my case, being able to be a generalist means that my job is changing all the time. And I love that. I feel challenged all the time, and I love that. And I'm learning constantly about things that aren't my main line of work. And I just want more of that. So to be pigeonholed into one thing would be really painful, whereas other people would probably feel very comfortable and find a lot of joy in that. And I don't want to take that from them,
Sure. Sure. I mean, I definitely think I'm a generalist too. And I think, I think there's a difference between a generalist and then someone who can do everything. And that's what people want nowadays, is someone who can do everything. And that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
But I would say with you though, you're in a unique position because you're a specialized generalist.
Correct. Yes, that's exactly it. Thank you for that. Yes. That's exactly it. My output is very specific, but my process is very broad. And I think within that, there's a lot of room for flexibility because it means the vehicle of my work will always be changing. And especially when I came into this, I thought, okay, how am I going to put all of these weird skill sets into one basket? I'm going to pick lettering. Lettering is going to be my umbrella. And everything I do, whether it's branding, whether it's some sort of weird like social campaign, whatever it is, it's going to be under this umbrella of lettering. And that way it'll all be united somehow and it'll feel like it makes sense. And then from there it was like, okay, well, what kinds of lettering? Oh, I seem to be really good at this like food and object thing. Weird. Okay. I'm going to mess with this some more. And I remember the day I took my projects, like the projects that the graphic design projects, I took them off my website and I was so scared because I was like, oh shit, I'm really in on this. And what if I don't get work? And what if this is just the end of it? I'm here putting this bizarre thing out and people have to buy it. And yet they did. It's crazy. So.
Well, speaking of buying it, I'm curious because when you started out 6 years ago doing this, there weren't a ton of people doing it. There were, you know, you saw like Sagmeister had done a few things here and there that were kind of similar. I mean, definitely not the same. Yeah. And now I just blanked on the other guy's name. Starts with a T.
Alex Trochu, Sean that Freeman, Marion Bantes.
No, his first name starts with a T. Like Tom or
Thomas
Tim
Price?
Maybe. That might be it.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know what's going to happen is we're going to get done talking and it's going to come to me. Anyways, it doesn't really matter. There weren't that many people who had done it, and there were even fewer people who were that was really the only way they worked or the majority of the way that they worked. You know, and since you've been doing it, obviously, you know, people see and companies see and more people start doing it. And, you know, how do you keep fresh amongst growing competition? And how do you keep from inadvertently aping someone else?
Oh, yeah, that's a really good question. It sounds like you've been probing around in my writing.
I mean, I tend to keep up with my friends. So.
So that part is really interesting because I feel like if you're careful about it, I mean, if you feel like what you have done is individualistic and somewhat unique and merited on its own, you're going to be really careful about not only like coming into a space where you could be touching other people's work, but you're going to be thinking about people coming up behind you. And you're going to be thinking about A, how do you make space for people coming up behind you? But B, how do you hold some sort of barrier for yourself? How do you find a boundary and an edge? And I think everybody has a set of like a nebulous checklist of things that they feel belong to them. Very few people have one or two things that they're like, I am this person. I do this thing. You know, I have this color palette.
Right. Nobody just works with carrots.
Right. Exactly. It's like there are a handful of things that kind of go together to make you and your output what it is. And so for me, when I look at it, I'm like, okay, very thoughtful lettering, because it's easy to have bad lettering doing work like this. Working in analog is very forgiving. People will go like, oh, that looks really neat. But if you were to try to transcribe it to a vector, it would look like garbage. And so, you know, the level at which you have to bring your lettering has to be high. I put items all the way around it and would prop things and make it look like a table setting, or like this lettering had just materialized out of someone's meal and or out of their garden or whatever. And that was important to me for it to stand on its own, but at the same time to have some sort of reference point, more items to tell a story, a setting and a place. And I, for a long time, was using wood grains and natural surfaces because I thought that personally, it was abating the white paper thing. Like when you start to draw and it's an empty page and you freak the fuck out and throw your stuff and go clean your bathroom for the third time because it's scary.
Sounds like me on a daily basis.
Yes. I mean, it's still me sometimes. Seriously, it's been really hard to get over that. I started using colored surfaces and textured surfaces because they felt like they were full already. And so I thought, okay, it's not a blank page. There's something here. And so I started taking side shots. And I mean, again, like I have metered purposeful reasons for why I'm doing this stuff. But as your work gets away from you and starts being proliferated online, people are seeing it that have no idea who you are. They couldn't even associate a name to what they're seeing. They just know that they've seen it and that it's interesting to them. And so you watch your portfolio become a trend in a weird way. And it's the most bizarre thing because I liken it to having a kid. You name it and then it tries the rest of its life to get away from you. It's just, it wants nothing to do with you after that. And so you have to grapple. And I grappled a long time with like freaking out because I'd see people trying this. And I'm like, are they just here to have fun or are they going to make this their job? What do I do if they make this their job? Are they going to find markets in other spots? And will we just maybe occasionally run up against each other or will this like be more nefarious? I don't know. And so there was a lot of questioning because I knew how good I was or wasn't. And I knew that, as I said, you need to have a higher level of lettering if you're going to do this. And I could tell I didn't have it where I wanted it. And so I thought, like, what are the chances that someone else is going to move on this eventually? It's got to happen. It's bound to happen. I didn't want it to happen, but, you know, this is such is life.
When people start encroaching on your territory, and when I say that, I don't mean like you don't have a market on dimensional typography and food typography and working in that medium in general, nor do I mean, sure, ideally, because you could rake in all the money and, you know, the capitalist mindset, you know, it would be great if you did and everybody came strictly to you.
But that's not how life works.
in reality, you don't want that. You want, you know, you want other people doing it because that, you know, puts that little competitive edge in you and drives you to push yourself further and things like that. Yeah. But when it starts affecting your business, you know, how do you deal with that?
So it's funny you would ask that. I actually wrote an article, I think back in 2013. So right when I started, about observing Jennifer Daniel getting ripped off by someone. I don't even remember who did it, but the way that she handled it was so graceful. She went to them first and tried to reach out to them privately and talk to them. And they were just like, no, we won't hear it. And it wasn't until she took it public that they were like, oh, hey, we see that you're upset. Please, you know, we're going to reach out to you and talk about it. And I remember writing, like, it seemed that the best thing to do at the time was to start privately and to keep it kind of to yourselves, because the second someone escalates is the second that like people get nasty. And I saw it almost as like, we don't have HR if you're working for yourself. So you kind of have to like invent the hierarchy of what do you do in a conflict? So with me, I've only had a handful of people, like three people I've reached out to ever about any of this, where they got way too close or they immediately took some work that I did and brought it into their agency and didn't even bother to ask. Like, especially back at the beginning when this was very, very new, that was really uncomfortable because they had been liking my stuff and looking at my work and commenting on my posts, but then they didn't bother to hire me and then would replicate my work. So I reached out to these people and I was very kindly like, hey, I see what you're doing. I think it's cool. This feels really weird to me. It feels weird to me because, again, like there's an internal checklist. Are these people actively looking at my work? Are they trying to cultivate a relationship with me or are they just kind of consuming it? Are they very much like replicating the ingredients I'm using on the backgrounds I'm using? Are they trying to replicate my style of script that I've used in these similar projects? Are they... when they're doing this, are they saying, oh, I was inspired by Danielle, or are they just pretending that they came up with it by themselves? Like there's a list, like, are they using my brand language to talk about this? Are they referencing taglines or interviews that I've given? And it sounds like they just went and took it completely out of one of these interviews. Like there's a handful of things that when you start to add them up, one or two, you're like, oh, this is passable and fine. But when you start to get pretty heavy on the, I'm checking all these boxes, that's kind of when I personally felt I needed to ask them what was up. So in some cases, I went to them privately and said like, hey, I see you're doing this. It's really not okay. If you're going to make these kinds of projects, I prefer that you say that they were inspired by me because this is so close. I see that you've replicated a project I did for a client for another client. That can get you sued if you're not careful. And it's same script, same copy, same background, same materials, everything. Like, even worse than some things that I've made public knowledge. Like, and I had to be like, you truly cannot do this. And that's not to say you can't be a food typographer. You just have to not take so directly from me. Look at other people in the lettering community to get some separation, or just even better, go outside, get off your computer, go read a book, go look in your neighborhood, anything but what's happening. And I found that from there, some people went on to have very beautiful illustration careers, and they are incredible, and I'm so happy for them. Some of them got mad at me and went on to have food typography careers, but they never referenced my work like that again, and I'm happy for them. You know, some people sure. were cool, and it's just, it's really interesting to see the gamut of people getting caught. It's a very interesting human thing.
What do you do in the situation where someone gets caught, won't own up to it, and continues to do it? Because, and I want to preface this with, you know, there's that Austin, I don't know how you properly pronounce his last name, Cleon, I think is how you say it.
Yeah, that's correct.
That book, Steal Like an Artist, and then there's just stealing.
Correct.
And that, you know, all of us who are in this creative field, we're building on what we have seen other people do.
Correct.
And there's, you know,
all of us.
We're just finding ways to put our own twist on it.
Yes.
How do, you know, when you approach someone and it's like, that might be inspired by me versus, no, that's literally what I just did. And that's like, oh no, you changed a the to an A.
Right.
Or, you know,
right.
Or something that's like you've just changed up a little bit. You've not only taken, you know, because it's not about taking the materials that you use necessarily. I mean, there is the thing of like, you're going to use literally the exact, like you said, ingredients, because you're using food and those are ingredients, you know, and you take those exact same ingredients and you take the exact same color palette.
Right.
And then you replicate it like that. And the copywriting
is very similar. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it would be one thing if somebody did something and they used the same ingredients and the same color palette as you and maybe just, you know, reworked it, but the copy, like, it was for a completely different project.
Right.
Copywriting is completely different. Not, there's not the same idea behind it.
Right, right. I think.
What do you do in that situation?
That situation is tricky because it really depends on the other party. I feel like the way that I've handled the situations I've had in the past, I've handled them all with like, hey, I respect you and I assume that you're going to be in this industry with me. So therefore I'm going to be kind, but I'm going to tell you that what you're doing is not great and you really shouldn't continue doing it because it's affecting, it's not good for me and it won't help our relationship at all. I think at that point, you then have to be prepared for whatever the person is going to say or do. And some people are reactive and they go, you don't own anything and I can do whatever I want. And I'm not copying you. Show me where I did that. Some people,
they give you a big fuck you.
Yeah. Yeah. Or like a feck you, depending on their background.
Sure.
And some people are like upset and they're like, oh my goodness, I never meant to do this. Oh, I would never want to do this to anybody. And you're just like, okay, well, I understand that nobody wants to purposely do this, but I'm showing you it happened. So just let's be cool about it. Let's just be cool. I think the way people react tells me a lot about, first of all, how they feel about owning anything.
Sure.
Some people come from backgrounds where they have large families, and so they don't have a lot of personal identity. They have to share everything. Some people come from places where what they have, they fought for, they haven't had a lot and they fight for it tooth and nail. And so it's theirs. They do their best to hold on to it. Like some people come from poor backgrounds where they don't know where their next meal is coming from. And so some of that is like, I'm trying to hold on to this because I don't know if it'll go away. Like everybody's got those things that kind of eke into business because we're people.
Sure. Yeah, we all have our insecurities.
Yeah. And I think the thing that's so interesting about copying is that so many people find themselves on either side of that argument, and the way that they react says a lot about which side they tend to fall on. So the people that I've noticed that are constantly borrowing from other people and or getting in trouble for doing so are the ones who are like, nobody owns anything. Nobody owns the right to anything. But the people who are like, actually, I know what it's like to build something. I know how hard it is, and I know how difficult it is to do so with integrity and to try to make my own space. They are the ones that are like, this is upsetting. Like, this is not all right. And whether they mean it to reflect on them or not is highly indicative of like which background they come from. And frankly, I think there's a lot to be said about coming from an illustration background versus coming from a design background. Lettering is kind of that bridge, the touch point of those two disciplines. With illustration, which is my background, I was taught to world build. I was taught that your story is based off of your personal narrative and experience. And so the things that you create come from the things that you've seen, touched, and felt. Whereas with design is creating pre-existing, you're moving pre-existing things and trying to optimize that presentation. So someone else took the photo, someone else maybe wrote the copy, and you're trying to typeset it, you're trying to lay it out, and you're trying to make it work. And I think people cross over all the time from those two disciplines, but that's kind of the crux of the argument, is that designers that find themselves in lettering or illustrative spaces tend to be like, well, whatever, I can take whatever I want because everything is free game, not understanding that illustrators are like, well, I had to build some of this that you're then... like that you're grabbing and using for something. And it's not to say that that's perfect. There are many illustrators from the past who have done horrible like things and ripped people off. But I think it's generally much easier to get caught in illustration than it is in design.
Well, I mean, Hanna-Barbera built their studio off.
Yes, exactly.
Ripping off Chuck Jones and.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
It's very clear.
Yeah, it's interesting because there is such a thing as parallel thought.
Yes,
where,
absolutely.
You know, and you know, specifically you see that in comedy a lot, like different people will have the exact same idea and tell a joke. And, you know, with most comedians, there's this kind of respect of, you know, oh, hey, yeah, you're telling a joke touches on mine, and they'll either back off or they tell it in such a different way that it doesn't matter.
Right. Think like about any conference you've ever been to. Eventually, by the end of the conference, everybody is kind of giving the same message. There's like a general theme to the conference because everybody has heard everyone else speak. And so they're like, oh yeah, I heard this person say this thing earlier and it reminds me of this thing that I also think. And it just keeps going. Like, that's natural because you're...
Oh yeah, yeah.
You're in the same physical space. You're ingesting the same things. Of course, you're going to have the same thoughts. I think where it gets really tricky is that you start seeing multiples of the same thoughts, and it just continues and continues. And again, it's that idea of an internal checklist. It's like, yeah, this might be the same idea. Is it in the same kind of medium, like same materials? Is it being played in the same way? Like, what is the end vehicle? Are they both like videos? Are they both stop motion? Are these for financial people? Wow, these are both for financial people. How weird. You know, and the spiral of similarity just becomes more and more similar to a point where you can't say it's coincidental anymore, because it's not. That's purposeful. That's intent.
Sure. Well, and correct me if I'm wrong. You know, it's not like you can go out to the companies that are hiring you or someone else or something and say, hey, you shouldn't. Well, A, it just makes you look bad if you go to them and say, you shouldn't hire this person. They're stealing from me. That just makes you look whiny.
Yes.
But, you know, when that good old corporate greed kicks in and, you know, people see two people who have a very similar style, who are doing very similar themes and stuff like that, the company's going to, you know, take a look at that and they're going to go with the lowest bidder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how do you work around that? How are you battling that?
See, that's a tricky thing, is like, the way that we have framed up our industry right now, and for this to happen to someone, the majority would say, like, well, not even the majority, just the loudest part would say, okay, it's your job to forge a new path. It's your job to take a new spot. This person's moving on your space, but too bad for you, they're coming up. And I think that's inherently wrong on a lot of levels. like it's wrong on a personal level, but it's also wrong in the sense that if you have someone forging a path and someone else is like standing on their neck, I mean, that's going to impede all of the growth for everybody else. Like, sure, that's going to impede a person's desire to make space for other people coming up. It's going to put strain on other people coming into the industry going, is this person also going to come stand on my neck? Like, that sort of thing. It causes so much unnecessary tension. And I think to stand on someone like that also is indicative of a scarcity mentality. Like, it's one thing to say, oh, this is, my work is being taken away and I have nothing. But to be like, oh, I need to take this person's work away or I have nothing, is actually a scarcity mentality. So not believing in your own voice or in your own self. When I look at this, I think a lot about imposter syndrome and how sometimes these behaviors come out of feeling like your voice isn't confident. You don't know what you are or want. And the thing is, I think the way that design is set up, you're beholden to the standards and the rules. Like, if you look at the rules are a grid. Mm-hmm. And we all know that the grid, you can measure your work to the grid, but it doesn't actually work. You know, the grid is, the rules are a system.
The grid is math. Math doesn't always add up.
Yes, correct. It's something where the standard and the rules are meant to be a mass-produced problem-solving mechanism. And so in and of themselves, if we align to that and only those rules, then it's dead. It's lifeless. It doesn't make sense. So we have to develop what I would call our style, which is series of calculated errors. So these errors are things where I just like my Y looking loopy like that. I know it's stupid and it doesn't look like any Y I've ever seen in school, but I like it. I know that the spacing on this is really messed up and I know that the layout is just all over the place, but I think it's interesting. And when you start looking at people who have done that over the course of their careers, you realize, like, if I wanted to pick this apart for being X, Y, or Z, I could. But they are doing something that makes sense in the context of their world. And so they stand up against the rules and go, I know this is what I was told, but this is what I'm actually offering. This is what I think is important. And I think by doing so, it cements that our individuality is our strength. It's not our weakness. But we act like, because design is somewhat about conformity, that individualism is a liability, and it's not. It's how we survive.
Sure. How do you, because you touched on something here, and I don't necessarily 100% agree with you on it.
Sure.
I mostly agree with you on it. I mean, I think there is a point where, when you said, you know, when you see somebody coming up on you, it's your job to, you know, people think it's your job to move forward and, you know, all that. I mean, I think there is a little bit of truth in that, though. It's, you know, but do you find that it's, I think it's, I'm trying to figure out how to word this into a question.
Sure,
but it's for me, I see it as we've got to constantly keep evolving.
Yeah. Oh, and
we've
of course.
We've got to constantly keep pushing ourselves and growing from that. And we either, you know, carve out a new niche, or we go a different direction, or we find a way to be more efficient on our path. You know, how do we communicate to others, you know, and to ourselves that this is what we're doing?
Sure.
This is what we want to do. It's okay for you to do that. I'm not trying to be combative with you. I'm not trying to tell you not to do your own thing and, you know,
yeah,
find that way to do it. How do you How do you communicate that to someone?
Well, I think it's the same idea of look at anybody who has been in the industry for like a decade at least. I think of Jessica Hish, for example. Jessica has had bread and butter drop caps for her entire career. Mm-hmm. That has been a staple. It will continue to be a staple regardless of what work she does. And she does a lot of different kinds of work. Mm-hmm. If anybody stepped to her, like to that drop cap space in the same intensity, regardless of how far removed from it she would be, I am sure she would have something to say to them about it, because it is very much a way that she still makes her money. And it's one of the things that she's most known for. So while like when you are in the creative spaces making money, you are constantly pushing yourself anyway, especially if you're working for yourself. You need to be constantly churning out new ideas, because there is always a chasm between the work that you get paid for by companies and the work that you personally do. And that chasm narrows and widens throughout your career. There are things I did 2 years ago that people are like, I don't know what the fuck to do with this. What is this? Why are you showing me this? And only now are they like, oh, that's really cool. If I post it again, people are like, that's so neat. And I'm like, where were you 2 years ago when I posted this? But it just didn't make sense. Like, I was doing a lot of apparel and jewelry and things like that, still made out of food, still with lettering. But people were like, why is a person in my feed? What is this? I don't understand. And so I think like one of the things we rely on as business people is like the bread and butter components of things that we're known for to get us through those hard times or through like sticky situations of learning and growing, because that's what we became known for. And so there's a component to that where it's like, if you try to hack someone off at the leg, you're not doing them or anyone else any favors. Because again, it's by hybrid growth. It's by kind of coming off as a new shoot on the branch, that the tree gets bigger, that the branch grows, that the spaces and avenues open up for more of that. So as people who have started doing things move on, which they naturally will, like you're saying, you're right, everybody will naturally grow and evolve. It's another thing to be like, I'm going to cut this branch off and light it on fire. Like there's a component to this where I would never come in on you and your livelihood. I would never come in on design work. I would never go to your office and be like, hey, I can do what Jason does, and I can do it faster, and I can do it maybe cheaper or more expensive, but regardless, I'm better than he is.
Especially, yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah, and especially if you're like, well, I was trying to get a promotion anyway, but what if I don't get this promotion? Now I'm screwed. Like, it's one thing if you've moved yourself and caught, then you're like, okay, I don't care. Like, I'm happy for you guys. Go get it. Do the thing. But like, again, coming in on overlapping markets, overlapping ideas, overlapping everything, that's super not okay. I do think you're right. Like, it is on us to evolve and move.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think that's one of those things that it, from a business standpoint, being in a creative field is very difficult, because it's not like you can put a patent on what we do, and you can put a copyright on an individual piece of work, but you can't put a copyright on a style, and you can't, you know,
kind of, you can do a trade dress.
Well, I mean,
trade dress is different. Yeah.
But that's really hard to defend.
Correct.
You know, and it's, you know, because again, it goes back to that parallel thought thing. So it's, you can do that, but it's really hard to defend, and it's, you know, finding your individualism.
Right.
And finding your own voice.
Right. And I think even talking about like the legality of it with the copywriting, the trademarking, the trade dress, like the reality is nobody wants to do that. Like nobody wants
That's
to
expensive.
Go through the heartache, the expense, like nobody wants to cause a rupture like that. Nobody wants to put out a cease and desist. I've never done any legal thing to anybody, because why would I ever, why? Like it's so much time and pain. And regardless, if you do legal things, if you do like go down that path of all of that, then all of your correspondence becomes public domain. All of your evidence is public domain. I remember a very famous case, very well-known case, where a couple designers sued each other a few years ago, and people were just pouring through the court papers. I mean, I took a look at some of them and was just like, I can't get caught up in this. This is so heavy and so painful, and everything was exposed. Nobody wants that. Like, sure. Nobody.
Sure. Well, I mean, so what are you doing to make sure that you're staying fresh, mm-hmm. that you're able to stay one step ahead of those people who, you know, are undercutting and, you know, basically hanging on your coattails, to move forward and to separate yourself and mm-hmm. reestablish yourself, I guess, right. would be the better way to phrase it.
It's something that I don't have a hard and fast answer for because I'm still figuring it out. And that's scary to say. I know that my lettering has gotten significantly better in the last 2 years, honestly, which is amazing because I've had a very rough personal time and most people don't grow like that in that kind of time. But the way that I handle my lettering is much more sophisticated. It's much more thoughtful. It's more complex. Mm-hmm. I think about the markets I'm trying to push my work into, the things that I've been pitching and the things that the people I'm pursuing are not in the food and beverage industry. I have not been working in the food and beverage industry for a long time. Most of my work has been in entertainment, automotive, some tech. Like, what's really hard to get people to grasp and a thing that I think will keep me moving ahead is that food and objects are metaphorical. They're not as literal sure. as people think, but the way that people want to use them, they're like, oh, you like using flour. Come over to my muffin company and make some stuff out of flour. I could do that all day long, but that's actually not helpful. I think it's far more interesting to be like, okay, here's a bunch of leaves. Make these into something for a health and beauty line that feels lush and natural and organic. Do that instead.
Yeah.
And then you're making these metaphors of like freshness and beauty. And again, it's just like a more layered message. And so the things I'm pursuing are like all of these objects, if they come from somewhere like regionally, they're political. They are capitalistic or communistic. In some cases, they're religious. In some cases, they're sexist. And it's a question of like, okay, all of these items, like we are united by eating. And that was a thing that I was really excited about when I started this line of work. Like the commonality is that all of us use these items every single day. Mm-hmm. But yet these things are also divisive and they have conflict. And some people identify with them more strongly than others. How do I influence that? How do I explore that idea? And so those things are really fascinating to me. And my work in some cases has gotten darker, but it's always with this strange, like accessible veneer of like, oh, if you weren't paying attention, you'd be like, that was really cute. But mostly that was a comment on feminism. Oh, okay. Interesting. Mm-hmm. So I kind of like that idea of,
well, I mean, you can do both though. It's not
it's not to say you can't, but the idea being like, I think most people, their first inclination is to go to the literal. And I think that's when people get into this industry, they're like, oh, I will go for literal things. In some cases, even to just be like, I made coffee out of coffee. Like you could do that and that's fine, but that's not any kind of message I want to put forward. I think I have more to say than that.
Unless they're going to pay you six figures and then you'll be happy to do it.
Correct. I'm like, what do I have to do? I will bathe in it.
I will sell my soul.
Yes, let's do this. Yes, exactly. And that's not to say like, again, like it's business. I like to joke with people that we're like sweatpant casual because we like to be all like good vibes and, you know, we're just a bunch of friends hanging out. But it's like we are friends that are making money and that have our deadlines and that have our rules. Like, it's the truth of it. And it's not to say we have to be assholes, but it's just acknowledging that that's the truth of it. We can still be kind and fun and easy, but yeah.
Yeah, you're not going to go onto a, you know, illustration board and ask who's got freelance work for you.
Right.
You know, because they're all freelancers out there who are wanting illustration work.
Right,
so
you're
going to be speaking to crickets. Everybody wants the same thing there.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And that's also a thing that I've done to differentiate myself is I hang out not so much in the lettering community. I love it and I like to help and I make myself available to it, but I spend time with photographers, videographers, art directors, people that are adjacent to me, because I know that if they need something, they're going to come calling to me. I get work from adjacent people. I don't get work from the lettering industry. Sorry, right. I wish I did.
Yeah. Well, no, because everybody's trying to get work from that in there who is trying to get work from that.
Yes, and I see people clamoring to like, almost like this weird surge of how do I get higher up on this popularity ladder? How do I like do a tribute to this person who will hopefully notice me and do a tribute to me? And like, it's just this really odd kind of circle jerk, for lack of a better word. I even did the hand motion that no one will see. But the idea of like, what is the point? Because yeah, everybody's like, you're cool, you're cool, you're cool. But that's not where the work is. The work is literally everywhere else, in the food world, in the sporting world, in the entertainment world, in the music world. Like, we need to go bring those ideas from those spaces mm-hmm. into this community, because that will continue to not only foster the masses being interested in what we're doing, but it'll also like broaden how we do it. That's that kind of like grabbing from other places. It's what keeps us alive. It's why they tell you not to marry your cousin. You know, you gotta go make the gene pool a little more interesting.
Don't tell Rudy Giuliani that.
I can't tell several of my friends' cousins that, because apparently that's happened to them.
Yeah.
Neat.
You know, well, and it's funny because, you know, what you're talking on there, I mean, I do hang out in, you know, like on Slack and a couple graphic design channels, but I'm not doing that to try to promote my business yeah. or things like that. I'm doing that just to have conversations with people who are my friends.
Yeah.
And it's like great. Most of the ones that I, you know, am in that are in the same field as me, there is very little professional about the conversations that go correct. On there. Unless, I mean, that's not to say that like if somebody has a question about, hey, how would you price that I won't like offer right, advice yeah. or, yeah. or, you know, hey, do you have a good resource for this? That stuff, that's, those places are great for that, for, you know, yes. resources and the same thing that you do. And you should be part of those communities.
Yes.
But to get work, you need to go outside of your community.
Correct.
Because everybody else, you know, everyone who does the same thing as you is trying to get the same jobs as you.
Yes, correct. Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
It is perfectly okay to be friends with them.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've even, you know, I've passed off jobs that yep. I, you know, I could have done, but mm-hmm. I either didn't have the time,
right?
The client couldn't meet a budget that I wanted to do, and sometimes honestly, it was because I didn't have the skill set to do it.
Right.
Like I, you know, I've had clients come to me who want a logo, but they want it in a very hand lettered style, and I'm just like, not that I'm not capable of doing it, but it's right. not something that drives me. And there's hundreds of people who can do it a lot better than me. And I'm more than happy to pass that type of logo mark
yes.
on to somebody.
I understand that completely.
But I'm, you know, I'm also still trying to get that branding work that
yeah.
so everybody else is. And,
yeah.
you know, if I can do it and if I have the time and if the budget's right and all that
yeah.
stuff, you better damn well believe that I'm going to be doing that
correct.
Work.
Yeah.
And I'm going to get ticked off when somebody, you know, says, you know, I can do that work for $1,000 less than so-and-so. And
right.
it's like, and you know that they're just barely squeaking by just to get that work. And they're having to take on times as much. And you're like, you're doing us all a disservice.
Yes, correct. And it's something where you're right. Like there have been plenty of times where I've either passed something to someone in the dimensional type industry, or I've helped them quote their jobs, or they've been like, mm-hmm. hey, someone approached me about this. And I'm like, okay, who is this and what are they doing? All this stuff. And then like trying to help them figure out how to get the job, because I want them to have it. Like, I think that's
yeah.
so important, you know, and especially I'm
oh, yeah.
honored that they would even ask me, like, give me that peer into their lives, because it's vulnerable. It's really uncomfortable. Like,
well, yeah, that's one of those things. I think there's a competition mindset. Like there's healthy competition and not mm-hmm. healthy competition.
Yes.
And there is this unhealthy competition where you feel like if the people around you are successful, you're failing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I think there's too many people out there in the quote unquote design world nowadays who have taken that mentality on.
Yeah, exactly.
Instead of being happy when there people around you are succeeding and
seeing
that, you know, the more people who are successful at doing what you do and are charging fair rates and things like that, it makes the world better for all of those people.
Yes.
And I don't say that in some hippy dippy, you know,
no, it's
I'm going to, you know, run off and join a commune sort of way. It's just, you know, if we all do better, everybody, you know, if we all individually do better, we all as a group do better.
I think it's strange because it is kind of like a socialistic thing where it's like you take care of yourself and you do your very best and you try not to, you know, be a dick to other people and everybody will do well. But I think it's extremely dependent on the people that are within the group functioning that way. It's kind of why socialism either ends up becoming communism or fascism, or like it's very difficult to keep a socialist environment moving.
Yeah.
And that's not to say it can't happen, but I think you are right. Like in the greater scheme of things, for someone to win a thing doesn't mean that you've lost. It's very true because it means they have their own story. They have their own thing that they're doing. And provided they're living the best version of their lives that they can, I mean, that's wonderful. They should live it. They should do it. I think where that becomes really unusual. And again, I've had extreme experiences in this, like the 1% I've had extreme experiences of, where my work has been appropriated because it was on a brief that then someone else ended up taking, using and not changing at all. Like that's not okay. That's like money out of my mouth. Versus like being like, oh, I saw this idea once, I'm going to replicate it for a different job. Then that's like money out of my pocket. And I think those are the two things that end up enforcing negative competition when nobody wants or needs that. Nobody wants conflict like that. And nobody wants to be the person to go, excuse me, I have to talk to you. Like nobody wants that.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Nobody likes that sort of thing.
It's like, it makes everyone's life harder.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is something we could, you know, talk about for days on end and there would never be a proper resolution, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But,
because there's no magic bullet. There's
yeah.
There's no magic bullet for it.
No, there isn't. So kind of taking a hard left here.
Sure.
And let's move into a positivity note. And what are you excited about? What's bringing you some joy right now?
You know, it's funny. I have been really searching for joy because I've had a very difficult month of March. I published that article that we've kind of been skating around and it went very well and then also very badly. But I was surprised at how loud both extremes were, just a lot of energy. While I had published that within like 3 days of
publishing. Have you never been on the internet before?
Right. But I mean, I've never been polarizing on the internet before.
No. I know. I'm teasing you.
I know. And I'm letting you, but then I'm also like, but really?
Yeah.
Well, within 3 days of publishing that, my grandmother died. And then 2 days after that was my birthday, which happened to coincide with her funeral. So I was
sorry.
Just wiped the fuck out. I am just, I'm still exhausted.
Emotionally exhausted. I can imagine.
Yeah. And so that has just been so much like having all of these things coming in. So the joy that I'm finding right now is in the fact that I have an apprentice, and by apprentice, I mean, not a contractor and not an intern. Someone approached me. Their name is Jack Juris. They are fabulous. And Jack was like, hey, I moved to the city. I know you and I have kind of been like peripheral friends for a while. I really like you. And my partner has a job and I am looking for a full-time job. But in the meanwhile, if you would like help with some projects, X amount of days, I would love to just come in and help you. And I'm like, you know, I wasn't looking for anyone because I just didn't feel comfortable paying anybody right now. And they were like, I just want to help. I just want to learn. And so we worked out a system where they come in and help me with little odd jobs and projects. Mostly they're a cheerleader, but they also like go get stuff from the store when I need supplies. They have vector lettering capabilities, which I've been needing a little bit of lately, and retouching skills, which I always need. And so they have been helping me on a couple of these projects. It's very chill. And then we also sit down a couple times a week and they ask me questions about business and I talk to them about what I'm doing. So yeah, it's been really fascinating because I've never been in this position before, but I do think there is something to apprenticeships in a way that like we don't honor those anymore. I think there are times and places, like I always pay my contractors, and sometimes if the situation allows with my interns, I will pay them unless the school system or whatever that brought them to me dictates otherwise. I will pay them. But the fact that this person is just like creating a symbiotic situation because they inevitably would like to work for themselves, it's really cool. I love it. So I'm excited about that. I'm doing something a little bit different right now, which is creative direction. I've been getting asked to do this more this year. Some of it's panned out, some of it hasn't. But the idea of people coming to me going, we have a client. And I go,
okay, tell me more.
And they're like, we don't really know anything else. We just know that we like what you're doing and we wonder if you can help us. And so I'm like, okay. So I'm getting asked to do the strategy. I'm getting asked to do larger assets, to come up with the brand language and the copy. I'm getting asked to do all of these things. And it's surprising to me how seamlessly this works. Like, it's almost like through the last year, I've been put into situations as a sole proprietor where I'm going through training for like upper management.
So I'm going to put this out there. I think you might be the only one surprised that you are good at creative direction.
Maybe.
I mean, how long have we known each other? 4 or 5 years now?
It's been a while. Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it seems like a perfect fit for you because it goes back to that being a generalist. You've delved enough into all the different worlds of copy and design and illustration and photography and all that stuff. And that playing that chess and being able to play three-dimensional chess along with that, that I think that's a great skill set to have. And I think that's been your training all along to be a creative director. And I think I'm surprised you haven't done more of it up until this point.
Thank you. That feels really good to hear that. And that also is giving me joy. So thanks for that.
You're welcome.
It's so exciting though, because it's like you get to solve a problem in this very holistic way. And I have a friend right now. I've been teasing some work. I'm not going to say too much about what he does because I want it to be really beautiful when it's all said and done. But he has the worst logo mark I've ever seen. And it's on everything. And he shares his product with me all the time. And I'm just such a big proponent of it. And I tell all my friends about it and I buy it for them. And I was just like, can I just tell you something, Mike? Your logo is so bad. He's like, I know it is. I'm like, I'm kind of offended that you've not asked me to look at it. And he's like, I really could not afford an entire overhaul. And I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to do this for you. I'm just going to do it for you. And I cannot tell you, some of the things I've been doing for him are my favorite things.
Mm-hmm.
They're so fun because in some cases I'm trying to give you a visual sensation of how something smells and tastes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's awesome. It's awesome. And it's nice because in doing this, you get to see a person and all of their insecurities. You see them in all of their like strengths that they're afraid of because they don't know how good it can be. And you just get to like pull it out of them. I feel like when I'm around people and when I feel like I'm at the height of who I am pulling things out of people that just make them go like, oh God, I forgot that was in there. I'm like, this is the best part of you. Never forget this is in you. That's something that excites me. And I guess that's kind of what this is a doorway to that.
Very cool. So as we're getting close to our time, I've started a new thing where I wrap the podcast up by asking some quick questions.
Uh-oh. Okay.
Rapid fire. It's kind of the first thing that comes to your mind. The only rule, and you'll figure this out, is you can't pick the same thing twice.
Shit. Okay.
Oh, it's not anything bad. So, what growing up, what is like your earliest food memory?
Sitting on the counter with my dad making cookies, like pouring chocolate chips into a bowl. Yeah.
Good. I'm glad it's not the getting smacked in the back of the head for making the mashed potato mountain.
No, that was next.
What is your go-to comfort food?
On a regular basis, ooh, shakshuka. Shakshuka is one of my favorite things. It's warm and comfortable and perfect. Yeah.
Okay, so for, I know what it is, and I love it, and it's wonderful. But for people who don't know what shakshuka is, explain it to them.
Shakshuka is a Middle Eastern dish. It's kind of like a chili crossed with an omelet. So it's a tomato-based dish. Sometimes it has feta cheese or sausage in it, peppers, but it's very tomato-heavy, lots of paprika, cumin, and then there's usually eggs cracked into the top and then baked in the oven. So it's like this soft, runny, yolky, beautiful thing that you either eat with some sort of polenta or you use some naan, and it's amazing.
Or if you're in the South, grits.
Yeah, that too. And also with a little bit of cilantro on top. It is just perfect.
I pass on the cilantro because I'm weird about cilantro.
Oh, are like, you one of those people that tastes like soap?
Yeah, but like on certain things, like I know the need for it and I'm okay with that. Like I know that you got to have it in salsa. Like it really elevates it. And I like it like on a good banh mi sandwich.
Yes.
But like I'm not one of those people who like, I want more cilantro because it does taste kind of soapy to me.
Weird. Wow.
Yeah. My wife's the same way. My wife is the same way and she refuses to eat it. Like,
no, that means your kids are going to be that way. Like that's dominant, like soap cilantro gene. That's problematic.
My kids are such picky eaters to begin with that I, you know, if they even come anywhere near something that is, you know, green, I will be ecstatic. So
Jell-O's green.
They're okay with green Jell-O. They're okay with green gummy bears.
Of course, I figured.
Yeah. So, okay. So death row meal. What's your death row meal?
Oh my gosh. I feel like I just answered this from, oh yes. Los Guachos. Okay. This is very,
I don't know what that is.
I've been saying a lot of polarizing things today. I'm going to say some more. Los Guachos is a taco place on the east west side here in Columbus.
Okay.
It is one of the best tacos in the United States. Says the Food Network, Univision, MSN, Yahoo, and one other entity that I was really surprised about. Rachel Ray, I think. All of these people were like, this is one of the best tacos in the country. And they're al pastor with a little bit of like pineapple and a tiny little bit of cheese on it. Oh my God, that forever. That until I die. They know me by name there.
Okay, that sounds wonderful.
It's delightful.
I mean, I love al pastor tacos to begin with. But
there's a meat tornado.
Yep. So, all right. Final question.
Okay.
If you were going to open a restaurant, what would your restaurant concept be?
Oh. I had a joke when I was a kid that I wanted to open up one named Ampersand and we would name everything after fonts. But then someone actually opened a restaurant called Ampersand in the city. So I can't do that anymore. But yeah.
Going back to that parallel thought.
I know. Exactly. But I don't know that they've done anything like that. In fact, they haven't technically opened yet. So I'm like, what is this? You better do this idea justice.
I'm judging you.
Yes, exactly. I don't know. I feel like anything that I could possibly think of that would be a good name for a restaurant might also double as a metal band name. You know?
Eggs on your face. Hey, they haven't opened yet, so we'll stick with the ampersand.
Hot noodle. Yeah. Okay, thanks. Yeah.
Okay. Very cool. Well, Danielle, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. Where can people find you online?
That's a great question. Thank you, Jason. It was also lovely chatting with you. You can find me at marmaladeblue.com, marmalade, and then BLEUE.com. You can find me on foodtypography.com. Which is all food and typography, surprisingly. You can find me on Instagram, Twitter, Tumblr, Pinterest, and Dribbble, all at Marmalade Blue. And you can find me writing on Medium at mblue.
Danielle, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. It was great catching up with you.
Yeah, same here. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Go ahead and break some bread.
Okay.
You can find out more about Danielle on Twitter at MarmaladeBlue, and be sure to check out the links in the show notes for more ways to keep up with her. I hope you like this episode of Feasting on Design. Let me know what you think. And if you like it, leave me a review over on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Visit feastingondesign.com to catch up on the archives of the Creative South podcast. Get some cool swag like t-shirts and stickers that are on sale right now for 50% off with free shipping on orders over $25 when you use the code FREESHIPPING, all one word. Plus, you can keep up with the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Feast on Design. And I'm at Jay Frostholm on Dribbble, Twitter, and Instagram.